Tres danzas seculares, three secular dances by Mario La Vista. That's Micah Sasaki on piano and Coleman Itzkoff on cello. Let's bring up the musicians now.
It was May 1st, 2018, and we were broadcasting live on the WFMT radio network from Les Poissons Rouges in Manhattan. And the theme was modern Mexico. I had brought up a couple of friends of mine from Mexico City, including the composer Felipe Perez Santiago, who we will hear more from later, and a good friend of mine who was a mezcal distributor. And our idea was to do a concert of music of Mexican composers at Le Poisson Rouge, but also to give people a really special treat and include a mezcal tasting of mezcals you could not buy in New York City or anywhere in the United States. Now, don't worry, we did not bring these in illegally. We worked with the Mexican consulate to bring the mezcals in legally, but they were not mezcals that were for sale commercially in the United States. So your ticket included a tasting. My good friend Alejandro, and he is a master of, he's a sommelier of mezcal. And so it was a really, really memorable evening. And that was a piece by the great Mexican composer Mario Lavista. Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Seth Bosted. We are celebrating our 400th episode today. It's hard to believe, but this is the 400th episode of Relevant Tones. I started the program with Jesse McCorders all the way back in 2011 at WFMT in Chicago, and it has had quite a history since. We syndicated and were a nationally broadcast radio show for many years. Then the show was canceled. We didn't do much for a year. Then we launched it under the umbrella of Access Contemporary Music as a podcast. I no longer wanted to be the only host. Hopefully that's for obvious reasons. And so I was very lucky to bring on Stephen Anthony Rawson, Austin Williams, and Matthew Dosland to help me out. And what a fantastic job those guys have done. In fact, they do most of the shows these days, which is really great. So to celebrate the 400th episode, we are, each of us, all four of us, delving back into the past and revisiting some of our favorite moments or interviews. So I'm going to turn it over to Stephen Anthony Rawson.
Hi, everyone. I'm Stephen Anthony Rawson. To celebrate our 400th episode, I'm revisiting my conversation with Annie Gosfield from 2021. I chose this interview because it's one of my favorites, and I find Annie's insights into noise and music to be extraordinary and dramatically compelling. As a vanguard composer of her generation, Annie's aesthetics developed alongside rapid advances in audio technology. Her fascination with the soundscapes of industrial spaces and World War II-era telecommunication have brought samples of factory sounds and jammed radio signals to her fingertips through the keyboard sampler. In her music, I feel a tenderness and delight for the inherent beauty of the sounds she uses, and an understanding of the musical drama that seemed to be innate to them. She gives great consideration to the diverse spaces her music is performed in, and to the people she plays with, whether it's amongst the massive Diego Rivera frescoes at the Detroit Institute of Art, or, as with her opera War of the Worlds, existing simultaneously on stage at the LA Phil, and playing across the decommissioned air raid sirens of LA. For me, Annie's music embraces sounds that are strangely poignant, historically informed, and deeply personal, and shares their delight through musical narratives that are electrifying, playful, and often full of humor.
I have to ask you about your opera, War of the Worlds. I'm deeply fascinated by this piece, and it sounds like you had a lot of fun writing it. Could you tell me a little bit about how this piece came about?
It was one of the most fun projects I've ever done. Yuval Sharon is this incredible opera director, very innovative, and the approach is always something unexpected and wild. So I was actually going to LA for a premiere of a piece for two pianos and electronics, and I thought, wow, I've never met Yuval. Yuval used to live in New York, and somehow we had crossed paths on email, and I wrote him an email that said, I'd really like to meet with you when I'm in New York, and he goes, oh, by the way, I don't know if the LA Phil has gotten in touch with you, but I was interested in you writing this opera.
Wow.
I don't know, it was like some beautiful coincidence. The structure of the opera is a little hard to explain. It takes place, for the most part, in Walt Disney Concert Hall. But like War of the Worlds, it is centered on an account, you know, in the original War of the Worlds, a radio show, of a Martian attack. Now, the radio show was supposed to be a concert of dance music. So I drew on this idea of having something that sounds just a tiny bit influenced by what you would hear on the radio in the 30s. You know, lively, somehow dance-related music. And Sigourney Weaver was our MC So she would get these reports of what was going on as the Martians invaded Los Angeles. The reports were coming from three public sites, and they were in parking lots in downtown Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So you could buy a ticket. Well, it sold out. You couldn't always buy a ticket to go see one of the three performances of War of the Worlds in Walt Disney Concert Hall with the LA Phil. Or you could go for free and sit in these outdoor parking lots and see one aspect of the Martian attack. So part of the initial inspiration for picking these sites for the Martian attack was air raid sirens. So there's still air raid sirens dotted all over Los Angeles. And we took these air raid sirens and retrofitted them with speakers from Meyer's Sound. So they sound incredible. So these would broadcast the sound of the Martian. And this, again, one of Yuval's wild ideas. They were kind of suspended in a glass box.
That's incredible.
In Disney Concert Hall. So the whole of the concert would be at each site, but the Martian sound would come through the air raid siren. And the idea was also that the Martians had been hiding in these sirens over the years. 70 years later, they came out to attack.
That's so wild. You used samples for this project too.
I did a lot of sampling to prepare to write it. Like, mm-hmm. I worked very closely with the musicians who are in the La Serena Ensemble, which is what we called the trio that represented the sound of the Martian.
Right.
So me and Matt Howard, who is the percussionist, recorded a lot of percussion sounds that I used later that he played live. You know, a lot of extended techniques, a lot of things he specialized in. There's a lot of very specific sounds for the soprano, who is Hila Plitman. And I worked a lot with the pianist, theremonist, cellistista, Joanne Pierce Martin. So there was a lot of sampling that happened, but the sampling was used more for compositional reasons, which is another great use of the sampler.
Ladies and gentlemen, to assure you that everything is under control, Mayor Eric Garcetti has just arrived to address the situation. Mr. Mayor?
Just outside these walls is utter chaos. And if you are listening outside, find a stick, find a broom, anything to defend yourselves and our way of life here in Los Angeles.
Why in God's name are those bells ringing?
Ready to strike.
Wait a minute.
Ready to strike.
The aliens are now in sight.
Ready to strike.
Three of them.
Ready to strike.
The first, crossing the concrete banks of the LA River. I can see it from here, wading through the aqueduct. It stands as high as the tops of the skyscrapers. A smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. The people on the street see it now. They're running towards the east. The smoke's spreading faster. They reach City Hall. The smoke's crossing Broadway. Hill. Grand. Lord have mercy!
Ready to strike! Ready to strike!
Los Angeles, but we are saved.
The power of music has saved us once again.
I see a connection between you and someone like John Zorn, who would put together bands like Masada or Naked City, and have that band Life, One Life, and then a compositional life.
John Zorn was an important mentor and a model to me just because he does so much. Right. And, you know, he does it with full dedication. And he's also created a lot of opportunities. Not just as a model, not just like to show that you can do that, but also he's put out many of my CDs and featured a lot of my performances and curated, you know, my work at the Stone.
Did one of those pieces include the manufacture of Tangled Ivory?
Yes, in a way. I mean, that goes way back to when I first moved to New York. The manufacture of Tangled Ivory was written for the Festival of Radical Jewish Culture, sometimes called the Festival of Radical New Jewish Culture, at the old knitting factory on Houston Street. So, you know, he asked me to put together a concert, and moving to New York was kind of emotional for me because I moved to the same area that my grandparents moved to, and they were, you know, basically poor kids. I mean, my grandmother moved here when she was 14 from Poland. And I think she was expecting to go to high school like a regular kid and looking forward to it. And she worked in a factory. I think, you know, it was so difficult for them. And people talk about making sacrifices now, but they were really making sacrifices and, you know, allowed for the next generation to have much easier life and allowed for me and my siblings to be able to pursue art. So I was really struck by the contrast in our experiences. So I wrote this piece that has a lot of factory influence and a lot of metal, because my grandfather was a scrap metal dealer. The story has it, went up and down Second Avenue with a cart and a donkey. Wow. Imagine that. And now I live on Second Avenue.
I want to ask about sampling, maybe more broadly first. I'm wondering what drew you to sampling initially.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think sometimes people take a while to find the perfect instrument for them. And piano is very important to me. And I also got involved with playing synthesizers, both in college, you know, with Moog modular systems and smaller, more portable things that became available in the 80s. But the sampler, once it became affordable, you know, after the Fairlight, after the emulator, it just made such a huge difference in my music, because I could just manipulate these small bits of sound. I could use traditional sources like piano and relayer them and retune them, or I could use something like these radio sounds. And being able to use the interface of a keyboard, which is familiar and performative, you know, there's established technique for it that I had already studied. This is just the perfect instrument for me. You know, both for things like the manufacture of tangled ivory that are very structured, and for more abstract improvisation. The first part of the manufacture of tangled ivory was very specifically for the ASR-10. The ASR-10 is pretty obsolete now. So one other thing I've learned is if you want to use this kind of technology, you have to be mentally and emotionally prepared for your piece, for your music to be a little ephemeral. I mean, fixed media kind of gets rid of that problem, and I write plenty of pieces with fixed media, but I love having people being able to actually play the sample just the way they would be playing a piano.
Thank you. Hey, folks. Welcome to our 400th episode. I chose my interview with Nick Zulick, who has become actually a really good friend of mine here in Chicago and a musical collaborator. We had a chance to collaborate on a concert at Access Contemporary Music's Thirsty Ears Festival, and it was quite excellent. And Nick's not the only collaborations kind of come through this podcasting experience with me in Relevant Tones. I was also able to work with bass player and performer Barry Paul Clark and his Tontine Ensemble. So I think that I wanted to choose just an interview or an individual that really I was able to kind of connect with further past the interview of the show. And the sound snippet that I chose really highlights, I think, this connection that Nick and I both shared between both him growing up in Wisconsin and myself living in the area or the state for a while, and the really wonderfully weird atmosphere and music collaborations that occur in that in that state. He's from Milwaukee. I was in Eau Claire for a bit of time, and we talk about the Minneapolis scene. So I hope you enjoy listening to this interview again. It was quite lovely to chat with Nick, and I look forward to doing many, many more episodes with Relevant Tones.
But I hear this like connection in your music somehow to like the indie folk scene that kind of comes from Wisconsin or comes from like that area, whatever you want to call it. I call it like post indie because it's more like this like idea of like the indie rock, but it really, I don't know, defies a bunch of stuff. But I think, who would have thought that like indie rock would be the one to like embrace like experimentalism? you know what it's like? I think that's such a funny juxtaposition, but it works so well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, man, I have a lot to say about that topic in particular. Yeah. So first off, just in terms of location, so, you know, you're talking about Eau Claire. I'm from outside of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. That's where I grew up, and that's the scene, you know, that I grew up
in. Sure.
And, you know, I was always grateful in Milwaukee. The nice thing about it is, you know, it's a city, but it's big enough that you can make a difference artistically,
mm-hmm.
in whatever that means to different artists.
Sure.
But it's also a nice size that you can experiment and, you know, you can fail. And that's just fine. And I really appreciate that about the scene. And honestly, I think that has helped cultivate this style that I think you're referring to. And I don't know what it is, man. Sometimes I say it's the glacial landforms and just driving back and forth through them, just, I don't know, it shapes the mindset or something.
Truly,
there is something about that.
Yeah, it's very like indicative of that. Like I hear, S. Carey's album, Ranging Light.
Yeah.
And like, there's so many like tracks on that, and I hear it, and I'm like, this is like the Eau Claire Valley. In a weird way, like I'm just like brought there, like instantly, and like there is an ethos or an aesthetic that like just is captured through sonically.
And on that album in particular, he does a beautiful job. There's like some sound design. There's that one track where he's like walking through the snow, or you feel like the footprint snow thing,
mm-hmm.
but it sounds like a very Wisconsin snow.
Yeah.
I hate to, I'm sure anyone listening would be like, well, walking on snow sounds like walking on snow, but and obviously I have a bias, but
yeah,
I think there is something about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's also interesting within that scene. And I'm thinking of, Chris Porterfield, who was at this show,
mm-hmm.
and his band Field Report. Because of course it's, you know, now it's Chris and then Barry, who you met mm-hmm. at the show.
Yeah.
And then Devin Drobka on drums.
Okay.
Who's really more in jazz land, but also a fantastic free improviser.
Mm-hmm.
As a side note, about 20 years ago, he was my high school jazz camp counselor.
Oh,
too.
Funny.
Yeah. And he was the one who introduced me, to Coltrane and John Zorn.
Mm-hmm.
I had found like Ned Rothenberg before that,
okay,
and Anthony Braxton, and he was the one. So anyway, funny connections
with
that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's another guy, this Tom Winchek, who runs in the same circles as Sean, as Justin.
Sure.
And, you know, the interesting thing about his music, he does a lot of synth stuff.
Uh-huh.
And you'll know his music from some of these synth, like, interludes that show up on these albums.
Okay.
I mean, that's really, that, if I'm not mistaken, that's him.
Okay, cool.
And he's so in the world of, yeah, experimental music, contemporary music, minimalism.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of ways, I mean, I don't know, someone should write a paper or something, or, you know, do an interview with him and just try to figure out what, how much that influence of him rippled throughout the scene in Wisconsin.
I think that, I mean, a large part of it, well, so you have that, right? You have you have those people. But at the same time, there's this like really prevalent free jazz scene in Minneapolis.
Yep.
Which people who don't know, they're always kind of like, wait, what?
I'm
like, yeah, no, like this, that's like the happening thing there.
Oh,
it's like like free improvised jazz. So like, and then you get characters or individuals from that scene too that are also collaborating in that. So it's really kind of like this, I mean, you could call it a melting pot, but I think you have people of like mindsets who happen to just kind of, there's like three Venn diagrams going on here, and they just like, it's always about serendipity, right? And like people meeting at the right place at the right time and being like, let's make this a thing.
Yeah.
That's my take on it without knowing these like individuals terribly intimately, but like,
I mean, you're totally right.
Yeah.
And also coming up from the South, just thinking about Madison and Milwaukee, of course, you know, Roscoe Mitchell, was in Madison for a long time.
Sure.
And then of course the connections of, you know, the AACM and all of that that's happening down here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Milwaukee isn't that far. Things tend to trickle upward, you know.
Sure.
And you're totally right. Yeah, it's this melting pot. And again, I think, like I was saying, these scenes are big enough to make a difference artistically, but small enough that I think people will take more chances.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have those Venn diagram relationships like you're talking about, I think it just leads to some really beautiful stuff.
Right.
And then there is this other, certain, I struggle with the name for it. If it's like this post-rock thing, this indie rock thing, the hip terms that I see now are more of like doomer or something like that, where it's just like these guitar riffs with harmonics and usually some kind of complex meter, or it at least sounds that way.
Sure.
And I mean, so it, first off, I'm flattered that you hear that. Thanks for bringing all that up in, in my music.
But that's
where I try to live.
We've heard so far from Austin Williams and Stephen Anthony Rawson, a couple of things that didn't make it into the episodes with Annie Gosfield and with Nick Zulek. And I think this is really something we should do more often, because it is really hard when you have this fascinating interview with somebody and then you can't get it all into the episode. I mean, there's so many things that are said, you know, for time constraints and to hopefully try to keep things concise, a lot of things wind up on the cutting room floor, so to speak. And this is a great way for us to go back and find some of those little nuggets that we didn't have before. I am going to go now back to Live from LPR, that Modern Mexico show, and we're going to hear from composer Felipe Perez Santiago and hear a piece of his. And then we're going to close out with more from Matthew Doslin's fascinating interview with David Harrington from the Kronos Quartet. And I was super happy that Matthew chose that, because there were so many great things in that interview. So please do stick around for that. And let's go back to LPR, May 1st, 2018.
Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Seth Bosted. We are broadcasting live from LPR in Manhattan. This is the second live broadcast in our new series, Relevant Tones, live at LPR. We are featuring music of Mexican composers tonight, which is really, really exciting. For me personally, I went to Mexico for the first time many years ago with my wife and fell in love with the place, started going back and studying Spanish. I eventually met some musicians, including Felipe Perez Santiago, whose music we're going to hear in just a moment. I've started working down there, and it's just a fantastic opportunity now to present the music of some of my favorite Mexican composers, not only for our wonderful audience here at LPR in New York, but also throughout the country on our syndicated radio program. So let's welcome our musicians, and we're going to start with a piece by Felipe Perez Santiago. This is a movement from his larger work, Hospital Suite. We're going to hear Nueroma de Morton. Thank you. Of Neuroma de Morton, which is a movement from Hospital Suite by composer Felipe Perez Santiago. We heard Coleman Itzkoff cello, Byom J. Kim flute, Mike Sasaki piano, Chaley Smith viola, and Suleiman Takali violin. And we have the great pleasure of having the composer here with us today. And I'm going to speak with him now. Yeah, big hand, please, for Felipe Perez Santiago. Felipe, welcome. Thank you so much. It's great to finally get you on Relevant Tones, and now in a live setting, no less.
Right. Well, first I will ask you another like amazing applause for this incredible.
Absolutely.
I just have to go and shake hands and everything, but they are far, so I shake hands. Thank you very much.
So tell us about the piece. What was the inspiration, the title Hospital Suite?
Yeah, I know. Well, this piece, as its title suggests, it was written in a hospital. It's a four-movement piece. I will start with a sad story, but don't worry, it has a happy ending. First I got the commission, which that's a happy part, from the National Fund for the Culture and Arts in Mexico to write this piece. And so I got a grant also to write a bunch of pieces. So this piece was part of that program. Then I was about to start writing this piece, which is a four-movement piece. Tonight you're going to hear two of them. The first one is what you heard, and the last one will be at the end of the program. So it's called Hospital Suite because at the time that I was about to start writing it, my mother and my ex-girlfriend, they felt like really, really sick. So both of them were at the hospital, in different hospitals. So I spent like nearly 2 or 3 months just traveling from one hospital to the other. So I was spending the whole day with my mom and the whole night with my ex-girlfriend. So fortunately, both of them are fine. I mean, they both survived. Not my relation, that's why I said my ex-girlfriend. But she's fine, I think. I haven't seen her in years, but I mean, at least she came out fine.
Oh, yeah.
So then the piece has four movements. Now you heard the third movement, and they have very strange names. I mean, for anyone if it's here, we have doctors. They will not find it that strange. But the first movement is called suprarrenal. The second movement is called vesículo biliar. The third movement, which you just heard, is called neuroma de Morton. And the fourth movement, which you will hear at the end of the program, is called Neurocardiogenico. So they sound as strange as to me as they probably sound to you. So during all this very, very long time I spent at the hospitals, I knew anyway I had a deadline and I had to finish this piece. So instead of just grieving, say, oh, my poor mom or my poor ex-girlfriend, which again, fortunately they are fine, I just took my laptop and a small MIDI controller and a pair of headphones, and I was just working at the hospital. And so the titles were the terms I heard from the doctors when they said, oh yeah, we had a problem with the suprarrenal of your mom. And I was like, okay. And they say, yeah, your girlfriend has a neuroma de morto. And I was like, well, right? So whatever that is, which I still don't know. I found them so cool titles for the piece. So, I mean, I just decided to take it with humor and said, I mean, anyway, I have to be here at the hospital, so I just take these titles and turn them into this piece that you just heard, the third movement.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're going to feature a piece now by Mario La Vista, and we have just maybe 1 minute.
The clip I would like to highlight for the 400th episode of Relevant Tones is a snippet from my conversation with David Harrington. David and I talked, you know, for around an hour or so, and so, of course, there wasn't room for everything in the final episode. And this excerpt is from our discussion on the origin of the 50 for the Future project. David talks about something here that I think a lot of people interested in contemporary music can relate to, and that is the difficulty of acquiring scores and convincing others that the music is worth learning and performing. David goes on to explain how this particular situation led to the 50 for the Future project and its serendipitous association with Kronos' 50th anniversary. Thank you for listening so much, and here's to another 400 episodes of Relevant Tones.
Well, here's what led to it. As time went on, Kronos was invited to coach young groups at colleges, universities, conservatories. And what we found is that the music that we played was really tough for other groups to locate, just the scores and the parts. Most music libraries in our country don't have Black Angels. They don't have Schnittke Quartets, Goretzky, Steve Reich, Terry Riley, on and on and on. It doesn't exist in most libraries, right? And so we'd show up, and there was always an excuse why a young group had to be playing Brahms or Dvorak rather than Arvo Pärt or John Zorn or any of the people that we work with, you know. And it began to get frustrating, okay? And this came to a real point when finally, after about 40 years in Kronos, I was asked to coach a young group in Black Angels. And I thought, wow, this is cool. Nobody's ever asked me. I can't wait to do this. Okay. And I was told that the group would have the music 3 or 4 months in advance. And then I would get to listen to them and maybe could help a little bit. And so I showed up and I found out that their instructor had gotten this young group the music the night before my coaching. Well, I know enough about putting Black Angels together to know that that's an impossible situation to put anybody in. And I saw red, number one. I got totally pissed off, number two. And I thought, we've got to solve this problem. There has to be a way around where the musical establishment are the ones that are providing the scores and parts for the next generation, because they won't do it. I had proof. And so anyway, that began this longer term conversation. At a certain point, Carnegie Hall was going to be celebrating a major anniversary. And I can't remember, was it the 125th anniversary of Carnegie Hall? I think it might have been. And they asked Kronos to, if we could do 100 commissions. 100, right? And I thought, yes, of course, we can do 100. And fortunately, Janet Cowperfoot, our manager, convinced me that 100 would be too many, but maybe we could do 50. And so then we proposed the idea of the 50 for the future to Carnegie Hall. They loved the idea. And then Janet and her team and everybody in Kronos kind of fanned out, and we began to make this happen. And so and then there was COVID. So actually the 50 for the future doesn't really have anything to do with the 50th year of Kronos. It has worked out that way, but that's not where it really started. But now what I'm really happy to be able to say is that anyone in the world can go to our website and download the scores and the parts. You can listen to each composer talking about her or his music. You can hear our recordings of each of the pieces. And this is all for free. It's a totally free library of recent quartet music. And you know, as a group, if you were to play all 50 of these pieces, you'd have a really large vocabulary to work with.
I couldn't help but end with another piece from Kronos Quartet's 50 for the Future project because it is such a cool project. That was one movement from Lu Yun's Temples in Taiwan, movement number one called Meditation. Beautiful music. Check out that 50 for the Future project. And that is our 400th episode. Hope we can do 400 more for you. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of integrating musical creativity into everyday life. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening.